Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGV. John and Dick make an attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meet each most Sunday evening to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio. The curious people are the ones that gather here that want to know. They want to know how this stuff works and how to make it work better. Quite possibly we'll have some discussion about what took place at Dayton, the biggest gathering of ham radio in the world, and that was this last weekend. We might also have a continuing discussion on how to use strip line for final amplifier procedures. That's what Rich N2EO is involved in. And any other subject that comes up, discussing things like how do antennas really work, how to make them work better, transmission lines, transmitters, receivers, all the different kinds of ham radio, 26 different kinds, and lots and lots to learn. Wireless technology is here to stay. There's something like 315 million cell phones being used in the United States. And from one point of view, the first cell phone really was a ham radio operator. Let me drop it. In some people's minds, the very first cell phone was really a ham radio operator with a handy talkie in his hand that had a touch-tone pad on it. And the touch-tone pad had a phone patch connection capability back at the repeater site, so that by dialing a phone number with the touch-tone pad on the handy talkie, he could get into the phone line by way of the repeater site. Extremely similar to what cell phones are like. And ham radio operators were doing things like that a little bit after 1970. So that was, 40-some-odd years ago. Cell phones have only really been popular for, about 30 years. And the true inventor, from my point of view, of cell phones was Dr. Reed Fisher, can't think of Reed Fisher's call letters right now. It'll come to me a little bit later. N2CQ? No, that's not it. It'll come to me. We sign into the TechNet by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this. K2KND, Rich and Yes. But do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name. K2RIW listening.
K2RIY. Joe. Yes.
We got Joe. Vito, I think I heard you say you've got a question. WA2PJF, is that true, Vito?
Not a technical question, a question about the situation on this repeater with the ghost. You know what I'm talking about. I haven't heard a thing in a while. I'm hoping he has been captured. Other than that, no, I have no questions. I'm sorry, sir.
Very fine, Vito. You probably know that it is the recommendation of the leadership of LIMARC that, with rare exception, what you're discussing does not get discussed over the air for a whole lot of reasons. So over the air, you might not get that answer. By way of direct contact with certain people or by way of telephones, you will get a more complete answer. All righty. So far, we got Joe, to B2RYY. Anyone else wants to sign in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RYW listening.
WB2OMW,
Rob.
No.
H2MMY, Ray, yes.
The US2 and Paul with a space report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Ray, I should know your call letters very well. MMY, is it KC2 or K2MMY, Ray?
Kilo Charlie 2-6.
Okay, we got you. And I know Rob said no.
XJN.
And Wes, we know we've got him. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KG2BHY, James and yes.
Okay, we got you, James. And one last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the net? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2AWD, Greg, just listening.
BUX, Charles, no.
Okay, Greg and Charles, people don't need to sign in just to let us know that they're listening. After 29 and a half years of the TechNet, and with 200,000 people signing into the website where they're all recorded, which is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. By now, we believe somebody is listening, so that doesn't have to be confirmed. And we save a little bit of time by only checking in the people who do have a question or a comment. So Joe was the first person tonight. Any further information, Joe, on those mysterious signals you've been hearing in the 700 meg frequency region, 700 and 800 megs? W-E-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
The answer to that is no, and that's not my question.
You don't have to discuss that. You've got the floor, Joe, so it's your ask whatever question you'd like, within reason.
Thank you, Dick. K2RWWE2OYY. This is a question on energy usage, which goes back to something I know you discussed on here quite a while ago, involving oil burner firing systems. That you think that question is still appropriate for the net?
Yes, I do. Part of the reason for that is that I, for one, have been servicing my own oil burner for 40 years. And there's some pros and cons to doing that. But we amateurs who have, in most cases, not too much reluctance to open up the case of a transmitter or a receiver, troubleshoot, fix it, whatever, we're all dependent on some form of heating of the house, be it gas or oil. And so, in my opinion, that's a perfectly good subject to be discussed, because the kind of guy who gets into ham radio is the kind of guy that can do that service. And the advantage of doing that is if you have a failure of your oil burner, 2 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day, you take the spare parts that you've gathered for that and fix it. There's no rocket science there. There's an amazing number of people who think that they can't possibly touch their own oil burner. Within reason, with the right kind of study and the right kind of information, I'm trying to remember the guy who used to live in West Hempstead, who was an oil burner repair person, servicing person, and also a ham radio operator. That's where a lot of the information in my case came from. So go right ahead with your question, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, very good, Dick. I remember in the past you were discussing about using different nozzles, and you were sort of against using what the manufacturer recommended. In other words, if the manufacturer recommended 1.25 gallons per hour or 1.0 gallons per hour, you thought it was a better idea to go down to 1.68. Well, I had my oil burner system cleaned and serviced about a month ago because I'm not really into that kind of stuff, but that's something else, all right? And I asked the guy exactly that kind of question. So I said, I have a 0.68 nozzle, as was recommended, that I put in there because it would burn less oil. And his answer was, yes, it burns more oil, but your oil burner is working harder to do the same kind of work. It's like trying to make a car go uphill with only working on two cylinders. And he says what he recommends, if the manufacturer recommended, say, a 1.25, you're that way, and it's not running quite as long. And I know Dick does not agree with this completely, but I'd like to see what your comments are with that kind of statement. Back to you.
I'm trying to think of the call letters now of a guy on Limark for lots and lots of years. His wife's name was Selma. Why can't I think of his name? Irwin, I think it is. It'll come to me slowly. Somebody mentioned Irwin's call letters, who accepted a contract from Brookhaven National Laboratory, oh, about 15 or so years ago, 20 years ago, and he investigated a large number of the domestic oil burners of homes on Long Island. And what Irwin came to the conclusion was that a high percentage of them were being misset. To have a person who services your oil burner as the same person or the same company that sells you oil appears in some cases to be a conflict of interest. Irwin found out that a large number of those oil burners were running too rich. In other words, a high oil-to-air ratio, which gives you some carbon monoxide, a sooty black flame, and in many cases a roaring flame. And he discovered that as you increase the amount of air, and in some cases the air is already set at maximum, therefore you have to go a little bit lower in the nozzle size. If it was a 1.0 gallon per hour, and you go down to 0.75, we'll say. In many cases, the burner will be running quite a bit quieter, and because it's getting a greater air-to-fuel ratio, it burns a hell of a lot cleaner. Let me drop. Along with that philosophy, when you have the oil burner set for highest possible flame temperature, good common sense would lead you to believe, hey, that's the best possible setting. I disagree. Because your nozzle is going to give you a certain distribution of particle sizes. In other words, some of them small, some of them medium, some of them large. They're not all perfectly uniform. If you set the air mixture so that you get the most amount of heat, you're setting the air mixture for the middle-sized particles and smaller. The large particles do not get thoroughly burned. Therefore, they're making soot. You set the mixture of air to fuel a little bit higher than that. You're now burning some of the larger and almost all of the larger particles. You're getting a complete burn. You're not making carbon monoxide. However, because the air comes into the burner cold, so to speak, the flame gets a little bit cooler. But because you're making less soot, in the big picture, you come out ahead. Because the soot, when it does deposit itself onto your boiler, is an extremely good insulator. You're now putting an insulated layer called soot in between your flame and your boiler. So I'd rather have a little bit too much air so that I get a slightly cooler temperature, but a more complete burn. And in my case, the soot that I get out of my oil burner is not black. It's brown. Thoroughly burned oil gives you a soot, which is almost not soot at all. It's just the mineral content left in the oil, which gives you a brown deposit. And you don't have to clean the oil burner. You don't have to clean the flue pipes anywhere near as often. And now I'm going to address your direct question. Let me drop.
Dave, you talked about what's up right there, quickly with George,
Now, whether or not the oil burner is working harder and working easier, very similar to an extremely well documented, not documented, well publicized, is one way of putting it. People believe that if they read in dim light, you're going to strain your eyes. You talk to a real eye doctor and you find out that's not true. People have been looking at objects. Whether you read or look at objects in dim lighting doesn't strain your eyes. The oil burner is not a person trying to walk upstairs and he's got a certain amount of muscle power and he's got a certain amount of weight. As you thoroughly burn that oil, it gives you a certain number of BTUs of heat. And those BTUs of heat, if your heat exchanger is working correctly, the heat gets exchanged in between the flame and your boiler. Or in the case of a warm air furnace, the plenum box, which exchanges the heat of the flame on one side versus the heat of the household air that you want to heat on the other side. So a properly operating burner gives you a certain amount of heat of the flame, and a certain percentage of that, hopefully a very high percentage, is transferred. Quite a few people I know have had a nozzle that's much too large, an improperly set fuel-to-air ratio. They're making a lot of soot, and they get a rather loud roaring sound out of the furnace. How in the world they put up with that roaring sound is that, well, it's always been there, and they got used to it. People visiting them will say, gee, how do you put up with that sound? A properly set burner with a small enough nozzle and a proper air-fuel ratio is an extremely quiet, very bright, yellowish-bluish flame, if you know what I mean. And you can, when you observe that flame, whether or not you're getting black tips off the top of the flame, it's telling you immediately whether or not you're getting incomplete. So,
Peter, timeout, cancel.
The original burner in my house was a 130,000 BTU per hour warm air furnace. I think it originally ran, I forgot the exact number, probably something per year, for 10 years. I'm willing to put on my ski jacket, if you know what I mean, or put on a sweater because the house can't quite get up to temperature. If the temperature you do, number in other words, just because the burn. Now, of some of my friends who have a roaring furnace making a whole lot of black soot and it has to be cleaned every day, every year, I told two or three of those friends, man, they got screamed at. all kinds of, short of profanity, the person doing the oil service said nasty things to him, saying, I know my business, I know what I'm doing, that I've never done that before, and I refuse to do that. That's not what the manufacturer recommends. To a man, they got flack doing it. See, so if you follow my advice, know that ahead of time. They happy about that. I'm not selling as much oil. I think you see what's going on in some cases. So V2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Very great. Very good discussion. How do you measure the air-to-fuel ratios that you've done it yourself? What instrument is necessary to correctly do that?
Most stacks will have a small hole somewhere where you can plug in a thermometer. And so you could be gradually setting it and find out what is the stack temperature. And when you get the maximum temperature, then you got the right amount of oil to right amount of air to burn the medium-sized particles coming out of the nozzle. And the larger particles are not going to completely burn, and you're going to get slightly black tips to the flame. You go a little bit richer on air than that, a little higher in air ratio, a little bit lower in fuel, the temperature will come down a little bit. It's a slightly less efficient burn in BTUs per gallon of oil. But because the overall picture is on the boiler, in the big picture you come out ahead. Turns out that with some skill, and this is a tough one, by looking at the quality of the flame itself is probably the best way. Yes, there is instrumentation you can buy when you go to some place like Sid Harvey, and you can buy all of the nozzles and all of the filters, and filters, by the way, there's another a library ahead of time, or buy their book. They got some very nice books giving you oil burner service information. Let me drop. So the flame itself, the quality of the flame itself, when you look through the observation door, will tell you whether or not you're getting any black tips to it. And if you keep going a little bit richer in air, until you get to the point where the flame now becomes a little bit unstable. When you got really too much air, the flame itself becomes unstable. But changing the nozzle once every year, I strongly recommend, because there's always a little bit of fine grit, which is eroding the nozzle. If you ever take apart a nozzle, and I mean really take it apart inside, you'd be amazed what really fine machining is in there, which swirls the oil just right. And whether or not you get a filled up cone there's an A type and a B type nozzle, and there's advantages and disadvantages of each one of those, or either a solid or a hollow cone of distribution, and depending on the design of your particular burner, one of those. All oil you buy, but no matter where you're getting your oil from, there's always a little bit of grit, always a little bit of water. You buy the right kind of a substance from the Sid Harvey store, and dump it into your tank once in a while. It's a small bottle of a fluid, I can't remember the name of the stuff. It gets rid of sludge, it gets rid of water, which occasionally will get immediately. The best solution is to use both. I've got two filters in series that I personally, now I'm getting a much cleaner chunk of oil, so to speak, that I'm sending into the burner. On top of that, Sid Harvey will sell you a bolt that goes into the center of that filter, the bolt that normally holds the can together, that holds the filter inside. You can buy a version of that bolt that has a vacuum gauge installed in the middle of the bolt. There's a hole down the center of the bolt, and therefore, as either of your filters starts becoming clogged, your burner is now sucking the oil and creating...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
As it sucks the oil through your filter that's partially clogged, it'll create a partial vacuum. So by looking at how high the vacuum is on that gauge, you know immediately, without even taking the filter apart, whether or not the filter is starting to become clogged. And so when I start seeing approximately 5 pounds per square inch of vacuum, it's inches of water. I think it goes to time to start changing the filters. So proper filtering is a good thing to do, the right size nozzle, and it takes a little bit of cut and try to learn how to set the air mixture. Instrumentation, what are you tuning for? Maximum temperature? Not necessarily. Minimum amount of soot? Probably so. And the minimum amount of soot is going to be when you have the maximum amount of air. So you got a little bit of a conflict of interest there. But I'm willing to sacrifice a slight amount of efficiency in order to have a cleaner burn. Uncle Willie Charlie is the name of the guy. W-A-2-U-W-C. He's a silent key now. Used to live, Bill used to live in the Hempstead area, and he was doing this service as a business for lots and lots of years. He agreed with most of the opinions I've now expressed. He's one of the very few oil people who will. The rest of them will give you a hell of a lot of flack on almost everything I've told you. Therefore, do your own research. Your mileage may vary, if you know what I mean. And I can't guarantee that I've given you the absolute best information. I'm telling you what has worked for me for 40 years. W-H-O-R-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
Comment.
Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
I don't have any more questions or comments to the subject because in this case I'm a student. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, first.
2-A-W-Z with a question.
AWZ recognized, but before that there was a person that said comment. Comment person, please give us your call letters and your name, sir.
Dick, K2GJE. It's called Sludge Buster, Dick. And you put it in when the tank is almost empty before the delivery. Over.
Very fine, GJE. Thank you very much. Sludge Buster is one of the rounds or so that you put in when the tank is nearly empty, and you put it in first before and gets rid of the sludge in the bottom. The good news is the stuff works like a charm. I've had clogged pipes. See, in my case, the oil tank is at one end of the cellar, and my oil burner is almost at the other end of the cellar, and there's a great big long pipe buried in the concrete of my cellar that goes from one to the other. And on three occasions, that pipe has clogged. And when I use the sludge buster, I don't get clogging. However, I also own the so-called CO2 gun, which you can buy at Sid Harvey. They sell this device that you put on the end of the pipe at the oil burner end. You put a CO2 cartridge in there. It pierces the CO2 cartridge, takes the contents, shoves it down that pipe, and you hear a bubbling sound taking place in your tank. And therefore, all of the sludge that was in your pipe has become cleaned out very nicely. And that cleaning gun works like a charm. And so the sludge buster also does a beautiful job of dissolving the sludge, dissolving the water. Let me drop. Because many people have switched over from oil to gas, and by law you must remove the old oil tank, and in some cases they cut open the oil tank to see what was inside, and in many cases there's tremendous amounts of this black sludge in the bottom of the tank that had gathered there for years because the person had never used any kind of a cleaning substance like Sludge Buster. The one disadvantage of the Sludge Buster is that people have discovered what a good job it does, and all of a sudden the price of the stuff has gone sky high. It used to be like $2 a bottle. I think they now went $16 or some crazy number for a couple of ounces of the stuff. It's gone sky high in price, although I think it's worth it. Because, let's face it, most of us are going to buy a couple of $1,000 worth of oil per year. And so to spend a couple of more dollars to make sure you put in some chemistry to keep the tank and the rest of the system clean, I think it's a good investment. Mr. AWZ, give me your full call and your name, sir, and proceed with your question or comment. K2RIW.
The call is KD2AWZ. The name is Greg. And my question is, what does the flare angle do with the oil gallon per hour? I noticed that your conversation was basically about the gallon flow, and then you came up with a flare angle. I know there are different angles. How does that fit into the equation?
Yeah, good question, Greg. When you get the instruction manual for your was designed, in other words, how wide is the box where the actual burning takes place? I'm going to call it the blast tube. And by the way, the so-called retention head burners are a set of burners that are a heck of a lot more efficient. It's just because of the way the aerodynamics is designed. You've got a squirrel cage blower that is putting air at a fairly high velocity down a tube they call the blast tube. In the center of that blast tube is the pipe that carries the oil to the nozzle. At the head of the pipe is the nozzle, and right alongside of the nozzle is another set of turbine blades, I'm going to call them fixed turbine blades. The whole aerodynamic design is trying to swirl the air just the right way, and now the size, depending on the size of the actual burner box itself and the location of your boiler, your heat exchanger, there is an ideal flare angle for your particular burner. I guess they get as narrow as about 45 degrees, and probably as wide as about 85 degrees. The flare angle of the oil being squirted out of that nozzle is not a super critical item from my point of view. I've done a little bit of experimenting with going slightly wider and slightly narrower, and nothing bad happened. But you will get a little bit more better aerodynamics within your burner if you choose the flare angle that was designed by the original burner manufacturer. There's various ways you can find out about that. There's some beautiful websites that will give you information on this. So not a super critical item, but try to match that. And also part of the design, let me drop. Part of the design of the burner, again, is whether or not the actual cone of oil squirted out of the nozzle should be a solid cone or a hollow cone. Again, the design of the burner is either an A-type nozzle or a B-type nozzle. You also can ask for hollow versus solid, but you have to know which one it is, A versus B. Again, it's not a super critical item. I've experimented with the opposite one in my burner, and nothing bad happens. But one of them works a little bit better, depending on the way the aerodynamics of your particular burner are designed. One other item is that when you start looking at the websites on nozzles, you'll discover that quite a bit of research has happened lately as to what is the proper pressure. Almost all oil pumps, part of the oil burner assembly, put out 100 pounds per square inch, and it's regulated. There's a gear-type motor in there, which squirts the oil into the nozzle at roughly 100 pounds per square inch. And there's a screw on the side of that mechanism, which when you turn the screw, readjusts that pressure. It's a kind of a regulator system. Like a voltage regulator, it's a pressure regulator. And so two other very important items are, they've discovered that when you set the pressure at 150 pounds per square inch, another good reason, by the way, to cut back on the nozzle size, when you go from 0.75 down to 0.6, so to speak, and you go to 150 pounds per square inch instead of 100, you get roughly the same amount of oil. But they've discovered there's a huge difference in particle size when you go to the higher pressure. You get a lot more particles of a much smaller size, and you get much more complete burn when you go to the higher pressure. And there was one other item I was going to mention along these lines. Pressure, nozzle, solid thruster versus cone, and flare angle. It's one other major point I was going to make. By the way, you can also buy...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's a fairly simple pressure gauge you can buy so that you can actually set that pressure, if you know what I mean. Getting the right fitting so that you can put it into the system and really measure the pressure that's going to the nozzle, getting the right fittings is a little bit of a pain. And you could buy a kit that has all of that in one place. It's a little bit on the expensive side. The actual gauge itself is, as I remember, is a $15 item. And the better made gauge has got, in the gauge itself, you'll see oil behind the window. That oil is a damper because the real pressure going down there is wiggling back and forth, so to speak. And you want a little bit of damping so you can read the average pressure. Back to you, Greg, and maybe I'll think of this. One other very important point I was going to make. Hopefully I'll think of it. KD2AWZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah. No, I have no further questions or comments. You seem to answer the question that I had. I understand what's going on. So I appreciate everything. Thank you very much.
Now, the only other thing you have to know about when you're doing your own service is to set the igniters. In other words, you've got two... Oh, yes, now I thought of the main thing I want to tell you guys. While you're at Sid Harvey, you can buy a delay onset switch. In other words, there is this little bitty electronic device that you put in series with the pipe that goes to the nozzle. That what that switch does is that it delays the onset of the turn-on of the oil by, I'm going to make a guess, something like 5 seconds, 10 seconds. The reason why you want to delay the oil onset is because when your thermostat demands oil and the oil burner turns on, until the pump comes up to full pressure and until the squirrel cage blower comes up to full RPM, you're not providing the right pressure of oil, you're not properly atomizing the oil that goes through the nozzle, and you're not supplying the right amount of air. Everything has to take some settle down time. So for the first 5 seconds, you're getting a very yucky burn and you're making smoky, soot, and all kinds of nasty things are happening. The good news is it's only happening for 5 seconds. At the end of each cycle of burn, something even more terrible happens. The thermostat's now, everything starts turning itself off. The swirl cage blower slows down, the pump slows down in pressure and in volume, and so the last little bit of oil dripping out of the end of the nozzle is absolutely not properly atomized, doesn't properly burn, it's making soot, and eventually a pile of soot ends up at the end of the nozzle because of the turn-off procedure. When you buy this time delay switch, it's electronically operated, it's very easy to install, and it costs about $15. And what happens is that when the oil burner turns on, the electronics is that turns on the motor also goes to the switch. The switch does not allow the oil to flow immediately. It delays it by
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
It delays the turn on of the oil by about 5 seconds. That's a huge advantage because after the about 5 seconds, your swirl cage blower is up to full speed. Your gear pump is up to full speed. The pressure regulator system is up to full pressure. You're now producing 100 pounds per square inch. The switch opens up as the oil flows into the nozzle, and you get a beautiful, clean start. At the end of the burn, when the thermostat says, oh, I don't need any more heat, the electronics turns off, intending to turn off the oil burner itself, the motor, but the electronics going to the switch that I'm describing, the switch turns off immediately. It's a slow attack, fast decay switch. When the electronics turns off, the switch goes into the closed mode immediately. So you're not dribbling out oil at the end of the burn, which is a very inefficient process, if you know what I mean. So you cut off the oil before it gets a chance to start dribbling out without improper pressure, and you also turn things on when everything's all up to speed, ready to go. The net result of all that is a hell of a lot of the soot that takes place on each individual burn cycle no longer takes place. A particular hot water heater I've got, which has got a whole lot of fine fins inside, where its heat exchanger is a very efficient device. That's the good news, but the bad news is that any soot building up in there starts clogging it real fast. Once I've added that switch, boy, do things get a lot cleaner, if you know what I mean. So when you do your own service, or even if somebody's doing the service for you, you can ask him if he's got the time delay switch, if he's got the right kind of filtering. You can ask him questions about the right size nozzle and gallons per hour. As you can tell, there's a whole lot of things you can do to make the system work better, and many oil repair people don't do any of the above. The contract is to clean the furnace once per year, to change the filter, to change the nozzle once per year, and other than that, they do business as usual.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Other than that, they just keep doing business as usual, in my opinion. I see a lot of evidence of that. Can someone tell me, Erwin Dresner, why can't I think of his call letters? What's Erwin's call letters? Anyhow, Erwin was the guy who had this contract from Brookhaven Laboratory to investigate the efficiency of the oil burners being used on Long Island. And he came up with some reasonably significant data as to what a significant percentage of those oil burners were not properly set. Anyone with any further questions or comments, give me a call that is right now, K2LIW and the TechNet.
WGB would come.
Go right ahead, John.
The only thing I can think of that you left out was the delayed ignition prevention, which has to be tied into that same valve. It wants to see an arc before it will allow that valve to open.
Yeah, I started talking about the igniters, and there's a very important safety device that's on your oil burner, and that is, in almost all cases nowadays, it is a photocell. There is a photocell in the glass tube assembly, in other words, right above the squirrel cage blower, going down that tube, the air goes down with the pipe in the center and the nozzle at the end. There is a photocell, and so the electronics of your oil burner is such that after the demand has been made for the oil burner to start up, it waits for a given number of seconds. I don't know how many, but if the photocell says, I didn't see a flame, the system shuts itself off. And you can get it to go back on again by pressing the red reset button. Be careful. Usually, if that thing went into the off mode, there is a reason for it. Maybe you want to You want to discover the reason rather than just resetting it dumbly, if you know what I mean. Oh, occasionally on a winter day with a real high wind blowing and a whole lot of Bernoulli's principle vacuum at the top of your chimney, maybe the flame gets blown out, although even that doesn't make sense because the igniters in most cases run continuously. By igniters, I mean, let me drop. There's a high voltage transformer that's connected to your oil burner, which produces something like 10,000 volts on the secondary winding. At 10,000 volts goes down these two porcelain objects, these two objects that are a porcelain coaxial cable, so to speak, with a wire down the center, and the end of those two wires right in front of the nozzle are two sharp points that are something like 3/16 of an inch is the proper spacing between the two. When you get the right book, there is three two points, and that's what really starts the flame. And there's a right spacing as far as the distance between the two sparking points are concerned. There's a right spacing as far as how much forward or reverse it should be. Should the sparking points exist out in front of the nozzle or slightly behind the nozzle, and how far above the nozzle. So there are three dimensions to be properly set. And once you look at the actual mechanism, there's a bolt that you can loosen up, you can move things and tighten down that bolt in order to force it all to be in the right position. And in some cases, those points wear a little bit, and maybe you want to file them and make them into a slightly sharper point. But the igniters, the right spacing in those three dimensions, when you get that set, you get a very nice ignition process where the air blowing through the oil burner assembly will take that spark and blow it forward, very similar to a Jacob's ladder, if you know what I mean, and the spark encounters the, what's the word I'm looking for now, the cone of atomized oil particles coming out of the nozzle and starts the flame. So the combination of that photocell is a safety device. Occasionally that ignition transformer has a finite life. In the 40 years I've been doing service, I've replaced that ignition transformer twice. And I've got a spare one because it is something that's going to fail on you once every 15 or 20 years. For mysterious reasons, For mysterious reasons, it will fail, and so to have a spare one is a nice thing to have. Again, if you get a failure of your oil burner system at 3 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day, and you know you're not going to get a service person there, the fact that you can do the service yourself and the house doesn't have to get cold can make you a local hero, if you know what I mean, with the rest of the family. So I think we've now covered almost everything. Ignition. Photo safety, nozzle, various kinds of nozzles, pressure, time delay switch on the oil, and I think you might be discussing another time delay device, John, so let me send it back to you. KC2WGB, and I bet you do some of your own oil service. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, at times when I had to. One important thing you mentioned was the cleaning. And to impress on people how important that is and how the insulation affects that burner and the heat exchanger, talk to a cigar smoker. You have to knock the ash off the cigar. It is impossible to light the cigar with an ash on it. Exactly for that reason, Dick. And, and also that photo eye monitors the flame. If the flame goes out, it will turn the fuel off automatically. And you should not press that reset button more than once. That's what most manufacturers would tell you. Because if you don't allow that chamber to degas, you could have an explosion. So, yeah, you just about covered everything today. Thank you.
Paul recognized. Now, where John said the word explosion, that's a little bit extreme.
No, I had one, Dick.
Okay. It's a bit rare. By that I mean, if something's wrong with your igniter, and so the nozzle is making a beautiful fine spray of oil, and the whole system will run for, let me pick a number, 20 seconds or so, without the photocell saying, I see a flame, and after that it shuts itself down. And if an extremely short period of time, you go and press the button again, you're now slowly filling up your whole chimney system with atomized oil that hasn't yet been ignited. And if all of a sudden the ignition decides to catch, yes, you can now ignite a whole chimney's full of atomized oil particles, and what you get is a very loud fluff, and you'll think it's an explosion because that expansion will probably blow apart some of the flue pipes if they're not really well connected together. Before we go over to Paul, let me go back to John and find out, that explosion that you got, was it caused by somebody pressing that button repetitively without waiting enough period of time in between for the oil particles in the chimney to settle down, so to speak, because he wasn't getting proper ignition? Was somebody misusing that reset switch? Is that what you believe caused it? Is question number one, John. And second of all, how bad was that explosion? Did the flue pipes get separated, so to speak? I guarantee it's nowhere near a big enough explosion that can bring down the house. An oil explosion is nothing like a gas explosion. If you're getting natural gas dumping into, let's say, your hold-on basement of your house, and it suddenly becomes ignited, yes, it can take the roof off the house. To my knowledge, oil cannot do that, but maybe you know of other cases. KC2WGB at first, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, my original burner was put in 1936-1938. I replaced it about 3 years ago. I had gone through that. I explained that to you, saving half the fuel. I had gone down to cut my nozzle sizes and everything like that on the old burner, but it just wasn't cut. What had happened, this is before the Beckett burner was invented, which was that one that has the eye, and many other burners also have that eye. And what happened, the flame was interrupted. It kept atomizing, and the flame came back on. Dick, it blew the window frame window out of the oil burner, blew the steel door off, blew all the 10-inch blue pipe off. It was a mess, and the firebox was actually burning because of the raw oil that was in it. Rare, but it can happen, yes.
Wow. In your case, that was a 1938 burner. Quite possibly that was originally designed for coal burning, and someone did a conversion on it to oil, is a guess on my part. Is that possibly what took place in this case, John? Go ahead.
That was a burner that could be either way. It had both doors on for a coal stoker, or that's where the Beckett burner or your burner unit went into. It was made to be either one. And it was a steel boiler with those huge doors that you have to lift up and put on the lock. It blew them right open. Blew the tabs right off them. Unbelievable power. But it's not a normal home. This is a poor family house. So this was a huge burner. It was about 6 feet long, about 6 feet high, and 3.5 feet wide.
Wow. Are you saying that particular oil burning assembly did not include a photo detector? That's why it didn't know the flame wasn't there, so to speak, and know to turn itself off?
That's exactly right, Dick. And that is something that was invented quite a few years ago, but the original burner was in there and nobody thought of it. And it was just an oversight. But you are right. Natural gas was a much more severe explosion.
Yeah, there's always a discussion going back and forth as to who gives you the most number of BTU per dollar. Am I getting the most amount of economy out of a gas-fired furnace or an oil-fired furnace? I think over many portions of history, oil comes out slightly ahead. And yes, to some degree, oil is considered a less clean burn, particularly because a high percentage of them are misset and they're making a lot of soot. Properly set, I think it's a very clean burn. But that's one man's opinion. Paul, I know you had a further question on this. WS2N, K2LIW.
Very good, right?
And Eric after that. Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
I just wanted to make sure that if anybody goes to turn these things on or off to get to the pump, you know, the basics, the little valves that they have, sometimes you have two of them, surrounding that oil pump hooked up to your burner. They're called fire-o-matic valves, and you have to turn them actually counterclockwise to make them go off. To the right, they're actually on. You know, they're spring-loaded, and they're called fire-o-matic valves, and there's a shaft in there. And if there's a fire, these things melt out, and the spring pulls it closed. This way you won't have that possible explosion that John's talking about, but you know any modern burner has these firematic valves on it. I just thought I'd mention that. You know, you shut your switch off, and then before you turn these valves, make, you know, it's opposite to common sense. You know, you would normally turn the valve to the right, you know, clockwise looking down at the handle. Well, this is the other way. Back to you, Jim.
Okay, what Paul is now discussing, the so-called firematic valve, is a on-off valve that is in the oil line coming from the oil tank over to the oil burner. The firematic valve, when you look at it, it's got a backwards thread on a rod going down the center of it and a knob sitting on the top that you turn. When you turn the knob clockwise, I believe it goes open. When you turn it counterclockwise, it goes closed. But the rod itself has a backwards thread to make that happen. The reason for that is it's got a meltable element inside. And the intention there is not to protect you from a improper ignition in the oil burner. That firematic valve is there to make sure that the 250 gallons of oil in your tank doesn't slowly start dumping into your basement if a fire in the house occurs. If your house is burning down and a whole lot of heat occurs in the basement, this firematic valve will automatically melt its internal meltable element. It will close itself down so that now the oil stays in the tank. You don't want to melt down the pipes that go to the oil burner during a real bad fire and now slowly pump all of that oil from the tank into the basement, adding it to the fire, if you know what I mean. So that's what it's there to protect. To my knowledge, it has no way of knowing whether or not the oil flowing through that valve going to the oil pump and therefore the rest of the oil burner, it has no way of knowing whether or not the flame is ignited or not ignited. Your photocell has to detect that. That's a bunch of opinions on my part. After we go to Eric, we'll go back to Paul if he's got any further words on this. Eric, I wonder if you do your own oil burner service, KE2EJ, and what was it like at Dayton today? I know you just came back from Dayton, and my guess is there were close to 20,000 guys buying and selling things there. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, you're right. You don't have to come back to me. 100% right. 100%.
Perfect.
Repeater.
Okay.
Repeater.
You've got it, Eric.
All right, Dick. I just spent the last hour and a half trying to get over to George Washington's bridge.
Well,
I'm on my way home.
Oh, it was fun there. There seemed to be a lot more people. The weather was absolutely gorgeous. It was actually too hot for a little while. It kind of forced people to go inside. You know, I used to take care of my oil burners, and now I have gas. The house in Astoria originally had a big old 1940 version. And the one thing that I miss is because it was made out of so much metal, and the house was heated by steam. After the burner would shut down, it would emanate heat for quite a while. So it kept a nice coziness about it. But BTU for BTU, and the way oil prices are now, gas, I guess I would equate the gas equivalent to $2 a gallon as opposed to the oil being $4 a gallon. I actually like the gas. It's cleaner. I really consider it to be more efficient. And with today's modern oil burners, there's not that much mass to them either, so they don't retain the heat when they shut off that well as the older things do. But then again, it took a lot more heat to bring the older ones up to temperature. And, by the way, the photocells are cadmium sulfide. And they're big things. It's really old technology. Yeah, I used to take care of my burners, and every now and then one of the photocells would fail also. But I'm glad I don't have that stinky stuff anymore. And what I did in my house is I did a whole lot of things. I actually got three different heating systems. Let me let it drop for a second. Since I do my own air conditioning too, I put in a heat pump. And that actually carried it through the winter while I was working on the radiant system that I put in the house. It looks like a champ. And it also reduces the amount of fuel because once you heat up all that wood in the floors and the ceramics, it just kind of radiates that heat for a long time, too. It makes you very comfortable. And then I also have the conventional convection with the manifold T's in them. I wanted to get rid of them, but then, you know, I wanted to put individual solenoids on each one of the radiators, but it just got to be a bit too much, so I stayed with the manifold T's and put valves on everything so we can balance the house out. But that's pretty much what I got to say. KTRIW, KE2EJ.
When you came to the conclusion that a gas-fired furnace is doing the equivalent of giving you oil at $2 per gallon, how long ago did you do that research? Was it in how many BTUs you get from the fuel versus how many dollars you spend? Was that the deciding factor? I'm amazed that the ratio would be that big. I've done the calculation once before, and I don't think the ratio was that big. I thought they were much closer to being a break-even. So how long ago did you do that, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
It's been pretty consistent over the past couple of years. It's about $2, between $2 and $2.50, because the prices vary. But when oil is at $4 a gallon, which it still is, actually, it's going to be a little bit lower this year, or this summer anyway. If you buy it now, so to speak, yeah, it works out to be about that much. And it's been pretty consistent over the last 5-6 years. So I actually know what my heating bills were previously when I was doing oil, and I know what I'm doing with gas. So, you know, I'm not going to argue with it.
Yeah, most people who make the choice of oil versus gas make a pretty hard decision, so to speak, and I'm not willing to change. I'm an oil enthusiast, and I'm not willing to change. I'm biased, I'll admit that. Also, since I do not operate with a contract, and I just buy oil on the spot market, I'm almost always getting it 15, 20, 25 cents a gallon cheaper than all of my friends with a contract. My friends with a contract are paying more for the oil than I do, and they're also paying another $150 a year or whatever for the contract, which pays for the cleaning. So, I don't have either of those charges. The next person on the list was Ray, KC2MMY. The Ray and Gabe show, both from Yonkers, KB2MAR, and I wonder if he's on frequency. Go right ahead with your question, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah, I was wondering, I have a couple of non-PL radios I picked up at a ham shack, and I was wondering if I played a PL tone loud enough from my stereo in the background, would that trigger the repeater? And, you know, not literally that, but you know what I mean, through the audio of the mic. And if not, why not? And secondarily, could I build one out of a 555 timer? I would assume that I could. Where would I then inject it? Typically, let's assume that the radio does not have an injection point that it's not made for a tone board. They are. So probably there's a pin on there where I can inject it directly. But I'm curiously, typically, if it didn't, where would I inject it? Could I do it from the mic pin without blowing up the audio input section of the radio? Over. K2MMY with K2RIW in the segment.
Very fine, Ray. You've asked an extremely good question, and there's a lot more going on than first meets the eye. Nowadays, when we buy brand new radios, 99% of them come with built-in PL tone capability, which you go to the right menu, you choose 4Z136.5 PL, and you're talking to this particular repeater. And that PL tone, you'd like it to be accurate to the nearest half a hertz in that order. It's got to be very accurate to properly operate the repeater. So frequency accuracy is one thing, and it should be a sine wave. You make a tone generator out of a 555, which tends to make a square wave. You then got to go through some fancy filtering, low-pass filter of some kind, in order to make it into a fairly clean-looking sine wave. But now there's a catch. You'd be amazed how many guys in the old days, when PL started becoming popular, and they would take a rig that didn't have PL, and they add PL to it. And there's a couple of companies making these little printed circuit board assemblies. You feed the right voltage into it, and it makes this beautiful tone. It's got a volume control on it, and you inject it somewhere in the audio circuit of your radio. There's the catch. Let me drop.
Spectcom.
Spectcom is one of the companies that is very popular for making these things.
Comspec.
There you go. Comspec. Absolutely. Okay. However, you'd be amazed how many guys made the mistake of putting the PL tone generator in the microphone circuit. wrong, because the nice thing about FM is that if the speech is properly speech clipped is not the right word. Let's call it speech processed. What was that again?
You want to get it in after the preemptive.
You're jumping ahead three steps. Let me get there. the speech going into your FM rig, real human speech, has a 23 dB crest factor. In other words, the puffs of your speech when you make certain letters of the alphabet, so to speak, has a whole lot of power that hits an extremely brief peak, but the average power is a hell of a lot smaller. So a properly designed speech processor for an FM transmitter takes off those tiny, sharp spikes that are part of human speech and lets the rest through. The reason you want to do that is those sharp spikes are very brief energy that have very high voltage, but they're there for a very short period of time, will create an amount of FM deviation that will walk your transmitter out of the IF strip of the repeater. So as you talk into it, you'll notice there's about two or three guys during the day you can listen to on the repeater where their voice is continuously dropping out. It's dropping out in many cases because the speech has instantaneous deviations that go beyond the IF strip. The radio says, aha, that radio dropped out for a short period of time. I didn't see the PL tone for a short period of time. And it cuts you off. The PL tone must be injected downrange of the speech processor and de-emphasis circuit, the pre-emphasis, de-emphasis circuit. There's a circuit in there that adjusts the frequency response going into your FM modulator, and that circuit doesn't do a very good job of passing low frequencies from your voice. But the 136.5 is a very low frequency as far as voice goes. Let me drop. So that if you inject the PL tone into the wrong spot, too close to the microphone, so to speak, not enough stages downrange, you're coming before the clipper, the PL tone gets square-waved, and it also, it has to be, because the roll-off of the audio circuit is such that it doesn't emphasize 136.5 very much, therefore you have to set the tone so darn loud that your speech circuit will go into distortion. So you're going to have a distorted speech, you're going to have a loud sounding, raspy 136.5 hertz sound coming out of your transmitter if you inject in the wrong spot. The right way to inject the PL tone is as close to the FM modulator as you can get, as far downrange as you can get, where the audio is about to be converted into an FM, voltage controlled oscillator, swing FM up and down, if you know what I mean. So there's a very distinct position, very far downrange, where the PL tone must be injected, not anywhere near the microphone, so that if you did it with acoustics out in front of the microphone, it's doubly wrong, if you know what I mean, Ray. You've used good common sense. I recommend you don't do it. In a pinch, when there's nothing else, you know, it's an emergency and you want to get through, yeah, what the hell, give it a try. But don't operate that way for any significant length of time. You're going to make yourself very unhappy, unpopular. KC2MMY, you're allowed to ask more questions on this one, Ray. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, that's that question. But then how come, just as the devil's advocate back, you can, and maybe it has to do with the frequency, you can use the DPMS over the, it may be injecting in a different... No, you can use DPMS tones right into microphones, audibly, even into a telephone, and they'll work and dial a phone number, so... Why did that work? Over.
Frequency.
Yeah, Eric hit it on the head. The actual DTMF tones are much higher in frequency rate than your PL tones. Your PL tones, the one for this machine is 136.5. That's a lot frequency, a lot lower than the tones that are used for DTMF. And some of the PL tones go all the way down to 88 hertz, really super low. You wouldn't, because of the capacitive coupling, which is limited in low frequency response between the individual stages of your audio, of your microphone circuit, are rolling off real fast when you get down to 88. It would be a devil of a problem to get enough 88 hertz for that particular PL tone, if your repeater needed it, get enough 88 hertz into your microphone circuit to open up a repeater. It would almost be a square wave by the time it came out of your speech processor, if you know what I mean. So you see the difference. Frequencies, PL must always be injected as far downrange as you can get it. Back to you, Ray, K2LIW.